For this evening, as usual, I'd like to lead you, to start with, to lead in some metta meditation. And we were just talking a little bit earlier about the nature of ethics and doing good, and I said from the Buddhist point of view that the whole, the foundations of ethics, the foundations of our sense of morality and right and wrong is based on a sense of beneficence, a sense of wishing well and wishing for non-harm. And I noticed, I've just been reading some guidelines for studying ethics. I noticed that this is, in Western presentations of the matter, is assumed. It's like it's a fundamental principle. And yet nowhere do they actually talk about how do you cultivate that. We're supposed to act as if we really do feel love and kindness for all, but we're not told actually how do you feel that. We don't address the fact that, in fact, very often we don't feel beneficent, yeah? It's normal. Half the time we feel beneficent, half the time we feel maleficent. And we know on principle that we should act out of the feeling of goodness, but we're not taught how do you actually do that so that you feel that sense of love and kindness. So this is what we come together to do this evening. Not just to think about the idea of it, but to actually do it. To really do it. To really feel it, to really experience it, not as an idea, but as that living reality in your mind. That actual conscious experience of loving kindness. So this is what the meditation this evening is trying to move us towards. So then I'll be teaching this each week during the Rains Retreat, and each week we'll be going doing a little bit differently, going a little bit further than the week before. So, but for this week, we're still going very slowly, so we're still staying with the first stage, that's loving kindness for yourself. Okay? So I want you to get ready for meditation now. Sit comfortably. Bring our conscious awareness to the feelings that we experience in the present moment. Noticing the sensations inside the body, feelings of tension or ease, warmth or cool. Trying to make anything out of these feelings, is knowing them and allowing them into consciousness. the mind starts to think about this and that, just quickly, energetically, note that thinking. Cut that off. Don't let your mind dwell or spin off in that. Inside those sensations, those physical sensations in your body, notice that there's like this color, this tone, this mood, this emotional coloring. Ask yourself, what is that? Bring up the words, may I be happy, may I be happy, may I be happy. Saying the words smoothly, evenly, carefully. May I be happy. May I be happy. May I be happy. Meaning every word. Putting your heart into every word. May I be happy. May I be happy. May I be happy. generates this sustained flow of intention, this aspiration for one's own true, deep happiness and well-being. As you continue, notice that along with the words of metta, in your heart is also the feeling of loving kindness. Soft feeling of happiness and joy. Very tender, like the wattle blossoms. Very soft, glowing like the glow of the moonlight through the trees. And you notice that feeling, just rest your mind with that, holding it, cherishing it very gently, in your mind. May I be happy. May I be happy. May I be happy. As the feeling becomes clear, then gradually move your mind around your body, spreading the feeling of metta with it, allowing that feeling to overflow, soaking through each cell and each pore in your body. Not going outside your body, staying in there, inside the skin, from the skin all the way to the marrow, from the soles of the feet to the top of the head, soaking through the beautiful, soft, loving kindness. coming near the end of the meditation, letting the words of metta go, letting the feeling of metta fade away. Allowing the mind to rest in a neutral place, open and spacious. While the mind is quiet and content, just take a couple of minutes to review over the course of the meditation, inquiring into cause and effect. What just happened? Why did it happen? What did I do? How did the mind change? How is the mind expanded by the meditation? Finally, we can dedicate merits to all beings. May all beings be happy. May all beings be well. May all beings rejoice in the merit that we made for our practice. May all beings finally realize Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. So in this series of talks that we're having for the Rains Retreat, each week I'm speaking on a different aspect of the 37 Bodhipakkhya Dhammas, the Wings to Awakening. And I started out with the first of those groups, which in many ways is the most fundamental, is the four Satipatthanas, the four establishings of mindfulness. In the last few weeks I've been talking about the first of those four, that is body contemplation, and focused mainly on two aspects of body contemplation, one being awareness of one's postures, and the second one being breath meditation. So for this week, we might move on from there and look at the second of the Satipatthanas, which is contemplation of feelings. So when we look at the four Satipatthanas, as with all of the groups of dhammas in Buddhism, there is a unity and a balance to them. The number four is deeply symbolic in Buddhism and always has the meaning of a harmonious and balanced, complete unity. And so we can't say that any one of these four Satipatthanas is any more important than the others. They're all just as important and just as necessary as each other. In some senses, body contemplation is more important in that it's the foundation for all the others. It's a foundational practice, it's the most basic practice. When we start our meditation, that's what it is. That's what we're involved with. We're involved with our body. When we get up in the morning, what do we have to do? We have to brush our teeth. We have to go to the toilet. We have to have something to eat. We have to breathe in and out. We have to put our clothes on. We have to keep looking after our body. So this is our most sort of urgent need, this kind of basis. But when we start looking at it with any kind of clarity, we ask ourselves, why do we have to do these things? Why do we have to brush our teeth? Well, if we don't, then our breath smells. And we don't like that. Why do we have to go to the toilet? Because if we don't, it hurts. We get an unpleasant feeling. Why do we have to eat? Because, we're hungry. We've got a painful feeling. And when we eat, we get pleasure. So we start to notice that as soon as we start to look at the body, we start to notice that the acts of the body, the things that we do, are being determined by feelings. And this happens on a big scale in our life. For example, we choose to get married because we think it's going to make us happy. We get a job because we think we can earn money and that's going to make us happy. We buy a house for the same reason. All of those big choices in life that commit us to many, many years, they're all after trying to pursue happiness and trying to ward off pain. The same thing happens on a daily level. The decisions that we make, when are we going to eat? What are we going to eat? When are we going to open the window or shut the window? Are we going to talk to this person or not? Are we going to read this book or not? All of those kinds of choices are always determined by whether we think we're going to get some kind of pleasure out of it or pain. And just on a moment-to-moment basis, every moment in your experience, you have these kind of twofold motivations, always pushing us and pulling us, trying to get pleasant experience. Even as you're sitting there right now, when you sit there and you feel a pain in your legs as you're sitting there on the floor, or a pain in your back, then there'll be this movement to try to move that and ease that. Or if you feel like your body settles into a comfortable position where you feel balanced, and then there'll be a move to keep that, to keep in that balance. So there's this constant dichotomy happening from moment to moment at every level of our lives, just seeking for pleasure and seeking to avoid pain. And this is what our physical world largely is determined by. So when we come to do meditation, we've come to look at some kind of physical thing like the breath or some kind of body contemplation, then it doesn't take long for us to start seeing the feelings inside there. So you should notice that when you're doing breath meditation, you notice, oh okay, there's just the breath, there's the air coming in and out. But then people have these different feelings around that. Sometimes the breath feels kind of rough. Maybe it feels boring. Maybe it feels pleasant. We kind of notice those. Oh, okay. And notice that the way the mind is being pushed and pulled around those feelings. One of the things that we have to notice, of course, when we start investigating what Buddhist meditation practice means regarding contemplation of feelings, is of course that the word feelings is used quite different than how it's used in ordinary English. Ordinarily, feelings means like our emotions or our moods. And in Buddhism and Buddhist meditation, it doesn't mean that, which is quite interesting. The word feelings is a translation of the Pali word vedana, and it means the, I mean, the best way of translating it is, or just defining it is, it's a little bit technical, but the affective or hedonic cone of experience is probably the best definition that anyone's come up with. The affective or hedonic cone of experience. So when we look at experience and our conscious awareness as it actually happens, what, has that got that tone of like attracting us to it, of like sticking the mind to that, or is it repulsing us, pushing the mind away from it, or is it just neutral? And these three, the pleasure, pain and neutral feelings, this is what Buddhism means when it's talking about feeling. Of course, when we think about emotions, then emotions are something very complex. There's this kind of multitude of things going on in emotions, partly bodily, you know, like these kind of physical manifestations of our emotions, kind of tensions or feelings or whatever they may be in the body. And partly it's emotions also partly to do with memory and association, partly to do with our intention. They're very kind of complex things. And of course Buddhism does speak of emotions and does speak of the development of good emotions and the abandoning of bad emotions. Okay, so that is not, I'm not saying this isn't part of Buddhism, I'm just pointing out that this is the word is used differently. So we've got all the good emotions, like, you know, faith and a sense of urgency. Sangvega is a very good Buddhist emotion. Sangvega, like being aroused, being... the word sangvega almost literally means emotion. Vega means to run or speed. And so sangvega almost literally means emotion. So that kind of sense of being kind of aroused to practice the Dhamma, being having a sense of urgency about what you're doing. Another very beautiful Buddhist emotion is the one pasada. And pasada sort of straddles two ideas in English. The basic meaning is clarity, and also means like faith, and also means joy. All of those things come together is pasada. And it's maybe similar to the English idiom where you say you clear up your doubts. So pasada is the state of having cleared up one's doubts and has confidence. So these are just a few of the very many emotions that are talked about in Buddhism, both good ones and bad ones. And bad ones like jealousy and anger and so on and so forth. Different kind of emotional states that we have. When we contemplate the feelings, we're not so much concerned with the details of those emotions. And that's important to remember when you come to do a meditation. You want your meditation to be simple, not complex. Emotions are complex. Feelings are simple. So this is why we're doing the meditation. We don't focus on our emotions. We focus on the feelings. Okay? Not to say you shouldn't be aware of your emotions, of course you should be. You should be aware of what your emotions are, and this is a part of any kind of contemplative life. But when it comes down to actually meditating, actually focusing your mind to gain unity and unification of mind, then we're asked to look not at our emotions, but at our feelings in this Buddhist sense. In a sense, this looking at feelings cuts through the complexity of emotions. Rather than trying to analyze them like we would in psychotherapy, where you understand, you know, there was such and such a cause in my childhood or at such and such a time, and then that's given rise to these associations, it gives rise to such emotional patterns and these kinds of things. It's a very kind of complex thing. Buddhism, you don't deal with that, we just deal with that experience of pleasure or pain or neutral. And again, if you want to understand that complexity, then when things become very complex, like when we understand our past experiences, conditioning, and all of those kinds of things that we do in psychotherapy, then in order to make sense of that, the only way to make sense of that complex of different things is to abstract it. And so we have to explain it in terms of various kind of abstract ideas, like we talk, you know, it's like we talk about an ego, or an id, or a collective unconscious, or whatever it may be, these kinds of psychological terminology, which are invented as like abstractions to generalize certain kinds of experience. And again, this is not the way that we do things in Buddhist meditation. We point ourselves directly at that lived experience. We don't try to quote-unquote understand that in a kind of rational way. We try to live it. We feel that feeling. You clearly and directly experience that. You know that. With a sense of reflection or reflective awareness, sometimes called reflexive awareness. You know, and you know that you are knowing. And this is how these exercises are constantly phrased in the Satipatthana Sutta. When experiencing a pleasant feeling, one understands, I experience a pleasant feeling. So you're not just experiencing it, you're understanding that you experience it. So there's this like self-conscious or reflexive sense about the awareness. You know what you're doing as you're doing it. And that's really the meditative dimension, isn't it? You know, anybody can just experience a pleasant feeling, but when we experience it, we know that we're experiencing that. And so I always find it, you know, a bit interesting to contemplate how these experiences of feelings work. Like, you know, we're kind of driven. I remember one time just after I come out of my first retreat in Chiang Mai, and I went to the market for the first time, and I noticed this one woman in the market. She'd bought herself an ice cream, and she was walking along eating this ice cream and just kind of walking through the market, distractedly looking around herself as she was eating the ice cream. Oh, hang on, what's she doing? Here she is, you can see there's obviously, you know, a motivation for this behavior. Obviously she likes a taste of ice cream and she's bought herself this kind of thing to make herself feel happy, but she's not actually experiencing the taste. What a waste, you know? All those calories, and you don't even get to taste the thing, you know? Surely if you're going, you know, if something's really that delicious, you know, ice cream, wow, it's supposed to be the most delicious thing you can eat. If it's really that delicious, surely you'd want to just experience the whole thing. You'd want to absorb into that feeling and just experience it totally without experiencing anything else. But actually you can't do that. And it's the same with everything. If you think back to it, the way that we experience feelings in any kind of worldly context, it's always like that. We're always looking for some kind of, you know, pleasant experience. But actually, when it's going on, what are you thinking about? And this is something that's very obvious, no matter what you're doing, whether you're eating food, or you're walking along in the park, or whether you're having sex, or if you're taking drugs, or dancing to music, or whatever. And people's minds always off, somewhere else, thinking about doing the shopping tomorrow, thinking about cleaning the toilet, thinking about yesterday's TV show, whatever it may be. All those things we look forward so much to doing. And actually when they're there, when they're happening, our minds can't be with it. You go out to, you know, an expensive restaurant with some friends. You spend so much money to buy all this incredibly delicious food. And you sit there chatting away to your friends and you don't even taste the food. Sitting there chit-chat, oh yeah, what was that? Like, oh yeah, you know, I've just paid $15 for these prawns or something like that, and a couple of mouthfuls, they're gone. Meanwhile, I'm kind of arguing to my friend about the football results, you know. It's like, what happened to that? Where did that pleasant feeling go? If those feelings are so good, if they really are so pleasant, why can't you actually be with them? What's wrong with them? And so there's this kind of constant searching for this, and also the seeking for avoiding pain. And we go to great lengths to do that. You know, we don't want to, unless it's cold like it is in Dandenong at the moment, or don't want to experience the cold, wrap up in blankets, can't get up in the morning, or I might experience some painful feelings, better stay in bed. If you, you know, you get near a fire or something like that, the hand will kind of automatically jerk away from it. And there's programmed response to kind of painful feelings. And I always noticed when I was living, you don't see it in Dandenong so much because you don't have so many bugs around, but when I was living in Thailand, of course, there's bugs everywhere. If you're living in the forest, you just get used to it. You know, the ants crawling all over or bees flying. One place I used to stay at, there used to be a beehive just underneath the kuti. And so I'd just sit on the veranda and read a book or something, and these bees would come and sort of fly around and land on your head. They'd drink your sweat. And after a while, you just give up, kind of blow them away, and you just sort of get used to it, and you're all right there. And you look, and then people come to visit you, you know, and there's a bee around. They're like, oh, God, you have this thing, you know, fussing around. I'm just kind of sitting there. They say, how can you do that with the bees? I say, well, I just gave up after a while. You know, it's just a bee. You know, they get an ant on them, and it's just this horror, this kind of reaction. They're like, oh, man, flick it off. Often when they're in front of the mosquito, the mosquito might bite them, and they'll slap the mosquito, and then they'll look very ashamed, and they're going to pretend that nothing happened. You know, so there's this constant movement, you know, pain, get rid of it, pleasure, get more of it. And we're always looking for that, you know, and it becomes almost neurotic, doesn't it? The way that these things are trying, we always think that we can get pleasure without pain. There's kind of a moment's reflection tells us, well, of course you can't ever get pleasure without pain. It's foolishness. It's absolutely ridiculous. We go to such desperate lengths to get only pleasure and no pain. And does it really change? You know, are our lives really any happier? Even if we can satisfy all these things? You know, I've lived in Thailand among very poor villages and things like that, and are those people really less happy than rich people in Sydney? I don't know. They didn't look any less happy. They laughed just as much. They smiled just as much, probably more. They didn't have cars. They usually had TV sets. I don't know if that was what made them happy. They had a couple of water buffalo, but they used to, you know, just like we were kind of complaining about the Sydney traffic or whatever, they complained about the water buffaloes, you know. There's something to complain about. You know, and we think, well, people come along and say, oh, I'm sitting in meditation and I can't stop thinking about this and that, you know, my life's so busy and so on. When you talk to people in those countries, they say, oh, when I'm sitting in meditation, I just can't stop thinking about my water buffaloes, you know. I mean, water buffaloes aren't all that interesting, you know. I mean, they're kind of big and they're slow and they're very stupid and, you know, there's not a whole lot to involve yourself about water buffaloes, but if that's what your life revolves around, then you think about that. So we can like recognize, and it's you know, if you look in the way that people in the world relate to these feelings, there's this kind of snobbery of feelings. Have you noticed that? Like people will think, oh, you know, if someone likes a certain kind of food, then they're good. I mean, if you like McDonald's or something like that, then you're kind of really low class. Whereas if you like, you know, gourmet French food or something, you're very refined. It's like, because I enjoy different kinds of feelings, somehow I'm better. Or like if you enjoy certain kinds of music, it's considered more refined or less refined, and these kinds of things. Whereas actually, we define ourselves according to our feelings. I like XYZ. I like rock and roll. I like classical music. And so we're like defining ourselves according to our preferences. We identify ourselves with other people who have the same kind of likes and dislikes. We belong to that group of people. And so part of our sense of identity comes from the kinds of feelings that we like to get. And as you can also notice that these things tend to change as life goes on. For example, when we're children, we tend to like very sweet things. Like to have lots of lollies, and as we get older, gradually our sweet tooth goes away. We're not so interested in sweet things and desserts and that kind of thing anymore. And our preferences, our likings and dislikings, they're changing. So even though we think we can, you know, be identified by certain kinds of feelings, but actually it's always changing. What is it? What is it that we're identifying with? So we do recognize, even in the kind of the scale of worldly feelings, we recognize there are certain kinds of things that are kind of more healthy or more beneficial, certain kinds of things that are more dangerous. We recognize that the very intense feelings we get from taking drugs, for example, that is very dangerous. And that the more gentle feelings that we might get from, say, you know, going for a walk along the beach, and get pleasant feeling from walking along the beach or walking in the park or something, you recognize there's something more wholesome about that, more healing. So we should notice how these feelings affect our mind. Because there is this sense of moving towards the pleasant feeling and moving away from the unpleasant feeling, when you have a strong pleasant feeling, then that pulls the mind very strongly. When you have a strong negative feeling, then that repulses the mind very strongly. Because the mind's being pulled and repulsed, like sucked in and pushed out very strongly all the time, then the mind like gets ripped up by these feelings. It's not unified, it's not doesn't have a sense of health about it, wholeness. So again, notice that in your mind, whenever there's like a strong sensation of pleasure, notice how your mind is getting pulled towards that. And that's almost like, you know, you can think of your mind as like a, you know, like the natural mind or the peaceful mind, just like a kind of a sphere, almost like a plasma sphere or something like that. And in this plasma sphere, then when, you know, when something comes near it, then it sucks the energy out from that sphere, it deforms it. And the stronger the sense of feeling is, then the more that will be sucked out and the more that mind will be deformed. And so all of those things that we think are pleasant are actually, the more pleasant they are, the stronger that input of pleasant feeling is, the more it's deforming the mind. And because it deforms the mind, then it reduces your ability to be aware. It reduces your ability to know. Because you can't know, then you can't even experience that feeling anymore. So this is like negative feedback, that the more coarse, the more strong your feeling is, the less you can be aware of it. And so more and more stimulus you require, more and more and more, to get that same hit. I read a brilliant account of that recently by a fellow, I can't remember his name, but he's become quite a well-known writer in recent years. He was a homeless man in New York, and a homeless black man, and he just became a crack addict. And he just wrote this kind of quite brilliantly about this, you know, like this experience where, you know, the first time he got himself some crack and he just had it, and it just made him feel like God, yeah? He was just filled with this kind of sense of power and energy and, you know, overwhelming sense. And that lasted like 20 minutes or something like that, and then started to go away. Like, I need more of that, where is it, you know? So I hunted down, find the second lot. The second lot, have it. Yeah, well, it's not quite as good as the first one. And then life just goes more and more and more, more and more and more, and need more and more and more and more and more, and it's never as good as the first time. Yeah? More and more and more and more you need it, and that becomes your whole life, is just getting the next hit, getting the next hit, getting the next hit. And it's never as good until eventually you need that hit just to be normal. You know, forget about feeling like God anymore, even if I can feel like a human. Yeah? And then it's like, even forget about feeling like a human, you know, at least I can feel like an animal, I can feel like a dog rather than just feeling dead. Yeah? And on and on and on it goes, more and more you need that. Until you have to break that cycle somehow, you either break the cycle or you die. Basically there's two choices. So the stronger that stimulus, then the more it's going to deform your mind. The less the stimulus, the more it will allow the mind to be whole and balanced. So this is why the Buddha made this distinction in Satipatthana Sutra. He talks about two kinds of feeling, Samisang and Niramisang. Samisang, translators, carnal or worldly feelings, and Niramisang is spiritual feelings. So this is like each of the three feelings, pleasant, painful, neutral, can have both of these three, both of these aspects, so it makes six feelings altogether. So the Samisang Sukha, a worldly pleasant feeling, it's like any kind of sense hit, food and sex and all of those kinds of things. And then the opposite of that, Niramisa Sukha, the pleasant spiritual feelings, the feelings you get from a feeling of faith, a feeling you get from a feeling of joy in coming and listening to a Dhamma talk, the feelings of peace you get in your meditation. Any kind of feeling of spiritual peace or uplift and so on, this pleasant spiritual feeling. And then the painful feelings, worldly painful feelings, the aches and pains of the body and so on, depression and anxiety and stress and all of those kinds of things. And then the spiritual painful feelings, yeah? Spiritual depression. And in the sutras it says spiritual depression is the feeling that you feel when you are longing for those states of liberation which you have not yet attained. Yeah? Sounds very familiar. Yeah? So that's something we always feel about in when you're doing your spiritual practice. Somehow there's a feeling of longing. Somehow there's a feeling of incompletion that I'm not there. Somehow I have this idea that there is this sense of happiness. But that's not where I'm at. I'm not at happiness. And so there's this gap. And because there's a gap, there's a tension. There's like a feeling of lack of completion, being pulled from one state to the other. Now this is this spiritual depression. And that's what they call the dark night of the soul. Yeah? The dark night of the soul. And the first and one of the most powerful descriptions of that is in the Epic of Gilgamesh, which is reconstructed from Mesopotamian plain tablets. And there's a brilliant passage in there where Gilgamesh, on his way to search for the secret to the deathless, and he just goes into this place of darkness and he just has to walk through, and it's just, he goes in there and the light disappears and there's just darkness, and he has to keep on walking. For one day he walks and it's just black all around him, before him, behind him, he can't see anything. And he just has to keep walking, and for the second day it's just blackness before him and blackness behind him, and he just has to keep walking. For the third day it's just blackness before him and blackness behind him, and he has to keep walking. For the fourth day, for the fifth day, and on the sixth day he sees a glimmer of light in the distance. And on the seventh day he comes out in the daylight again. This is this kind of the dark night of the soul. You all have to go there, alright? It's bad news. If you haven't been there yet, you will. And there's nothing to do, really. Yeah, you just have to do what Gilgamesh do. You just keep walking. It's not wrong to experience that. The Buddha never promised that you'll never experience sadness on the path. He did say that the path does lead to happiness, that's the good news, but he never said that it's all happiness. Sometimes you just have to do it. You just have to grit your teeth. Sometimes it just is all black. Sometimes you just look in your heart and it's just tragic. Sometimes you just look in there and it's just so sad. You see that darkness and that blackness, and it just seems to go on. It seems to just hang there, kind of drooping and wet and damp. Just like this kind of, endless kind of cave of depression. You know, how can I ever get out of this? A customer, I remember the image of the when I read the National Geographic a few years ago, and then there was a story about the caves a couple of miles below the deserts of Mexico, and in those caves there's no oxygen,
And this was being researched by these exobiologists who research into life forms from outer space. And they went down there to see what kind of life forms can live with no oxygen. And so what they found was these slime molds that grew and dripped off the ceilings inside of these caves, and they called them smutites. Instead of stalagmites and stalactites, you have smutites. And they were looking at being on the inside of a huge mineral cavity. Nostril cavity. That's what it feels like, isn't it? It feels like there you are, blackness, miles beneath the surface, miles from the sun, no oxygen. You're all alive. There you are, you're all alive. 5 miles beneath the surface of the Mexican desert. No human being has ever been there. No human being can ever live there. There's no air to breathe. Just you and the snotites. And you're going to die in there. And because there's no oxygen, your body's not even going to rot. You're just going to die there and be embalmed in the snot. This is the dark night of the soul. It's really good to face that, to really look at that. Sometimes you're trying to shine some light in it, and you can't. Sometimes there just isn't any light to shine there. How can you bring any light if you're 5 miles below the Mexican desert? See, you just can't do anything, so you just have to embrace it. You just have to be with that. You just have to accept that this is just it. This is what experience is like right now. But try to avoid what we do is we think, we have the idea, we form the concept that it's always going to be like this. We take that experience which is happening now and we extend it in time. Because we can't imagine anything else. We can't imagine a daylight. And sometimes maybe you're in your hut, you're in your kutia, in meditation, late at night, approaching midnight, and there's just this sense of sadness, sense of tragedy. And it just feels so real. It feels so, it felt like just this sort of truth. It's like you kind of hit this kind of bedrock. It's almost, it feels like, the truth is this black canvas. The truth, the bedrock truth of my mind is this black canvas. And I'm trying to write on that. I've got these kind of very watery little watercolors, and I'm trying to paint a picture over the top with a smiley, happy flower or something. But you can't even see this smiley, happy flower because it's just this blackness of this canvas, and that's real, that's truth. The blackness isn't the paint which I've painted on the canvas, it's the colour of the canvas itself. And anything else is just a fake. It's just this trivial lies that I use to dress up that dreadful reality. This is how we feel when it comes to that time, late at night. But even as we think that, even as we feel that, even as we feel that this is eternity and this is real, even as we feel that, even as we despair, then the earth is turning and the sunrise is coming. And there's nothing you can do about it. just live on the dark side all the time. And sometimes it feels like a betrayal. Sometimes you feel happy again. It feels like, oh, somehow it's too trivial. Happiness, good. Happiness, ooh. Happiness is so kind of nice and icky. You know, truth, we all know truth is black. Death is real. Life's not real. And of course, out of death, the only reason that death is real is because life is real. It wasn't for the fact that life is good and life is happiness in life and goodness in life, then death wouldn't be a problem. And so in Buddhism has this idea that it's like this interdependence, goodness and evil, happiness and sadness, light and darkness, they all exist dependent on each other, relative to each other. So when you have this like spiritual depression, then just bear with it, be with it. Just, there's nothing much you can do about that feeling, okay? You can try, but there's probably not going to do very much, okay? What you can do is just not eternalize that feeling. Don't believe to yourself that it's going to last forever. Okay, that's really the most you can do at that time. Just know, understand to yourself that this too shall pass. This too shall pass. No matter how deep it is, no matter how dark it is, no matter how black it becomes, that too shall pass. And then it does. The sun comes up. Life goes on. Happiness and sadness are there. They're both true. They're both real. So when you can understand this kind of duality of the happiness and sadness, then you develop a sense of equanimity about it. And so this is what that third feeling, which is really the most interesting one, comes. It's a neutral feeling. In Buddhism, it's usually described as neither pleasant nor painful. The typical kind of Buddhist way of saying it, rather than trying to say what it is, you say what it's not. Well, it's not this and it's not that. And it's something that's kind of left over. If you say, well, that feeling, but, well, that's not pleasant feeling, it's not painful feeling. What is it? And it's interesting the Buddha talks about like the counterparts for these feelings. So the pleasant feeling, the counterpart of pleasant feeling is desire, attraction. You know, when you have a pleasant feeling, you want more of it. The counterpart of painful feeling is aversion. When you have a painful feeling, you want to get rid of it. And the counterpart of neutral feeling, one has two counterparts. One counterpart it has is ignorance. And the other counterpart it has is realization, is truth, is awakening. That's why this middle kind of feeling is the most enigmatic, the most interesting of all of the feelings. Normally, when we experience neutral feeling, we switch off. We get bored. You're sitting on the bus. You don't care about anything. You get bored. You drift off. Or if you're sitting in meditation, your feeling is just neutral, and then your mind tends to get dull. You can't really sustain your mindfulness. That's the normal reaction to neutral feeling. So in that sense, the counterpart of neutral feeling is ignorance. So how do you overcome that? You have to overcome that with very strong mindfulness. And you have to overcome that by cultivating a gradual evolution, a gradual development of subtle kinds of feeling. And that gradual evolution of subtle kinds of feelings is precisely what we're doing in our meditation. We're moving from those coarse, disturbing, defiling feelings of worldly experience towards a subtle kind of happiness in the mind. And that's why it's crucial, absolutely essential, that we develop happiness. And sometimes, all too often, I'm afraid, in Buddhism, we are taught to fear these happy feelings. We are taught, no, if you get these happy feelings, you'll be attached to them. Oh dear, careful, you'll be attached to your happy feelings. What did the Buddha say about that? He said, na bhayitabham, do not be afraid, should not be feared, na bhayitabham. How many times have we been told, how many books can I go out there and pull up the shelf in our library of books that are supposed to be teaching the Buddha's teachings, and they say, oh, be afraid of happy feelings, here in meditation, when the Buddha's words, na bhayitabham, should not be feared. How much more direct do you need? How much more straightforward do you need? Na bhayitabham. It's not like a kind of pointed interpretation. It's not something which we need to debate about. Do not fear those pleasant feelings. What did the Buddha say about these pleasant feelings in meditation? Sukhukami sasamani. Feeling sukha, pleasant feeling, is the vital condition, the essential condition for samadhi, the unification of mind. When you have that soft, pervasive sense of spiritual happiness in your mind, then this acts like a very kind of gentle magnet, and it pulls your mind into itself and into a sense of oneness. You need that. You need that sense of happiness. Otherwise the mind will drift. Neutral feeling isn't strong enough. You will never develop concentration through neutral feeling. This is the word that the Buddha taught, and it's also what's recognized and accepted right through the commentaries. And Buddhist tradition, even though these days we're told to be afraid of pleasant feeling, and you know, sometimes the meditation teachers will teach us that, you know, you can develop what they call momentary concentration or access concentration based on you know, neutral feeling, and you shouldn't have pleasant feeling. Well, in the Visuddhi Magga, the main Theravada meditation manual, it says all kinds of concentration, even momentary concentration and access concentration, are dependent on pleasant feeling. And so that's not just the position of the suttas, it's also the position of the Theravadan tradition, the authoritative Theravadan tradition. You cannot get even momentary concentration without pleasant feeling. Even upachara, even excess concentration, you can't get without pleasant feeling. And this is what the Theravadan tradition holds, and it's perfectly in line with what the Buddha said. You must have that pleasant feeling that's going to let your mind settle. It's going to make you, it's going to seduce your mind into being still. So we notice the characteristics of that pleasant feeling, that spiritual pleasant feeling, compared with worldly feelings. One characteristic is it lasts a long time. Worldly feelings are very short. Eat a pizza, doesn't last long. Doesn't last long. I remember one time when I was a novice and I was with my friend Ajahn Chandrakar and his mum. His mum took us out to an ice cream parlour. We had ice cream sundaes. Sitting there, we had the ice cream sundae, and he just looked at me and he said, I know sense pleasures are impermanent, but do they have to be that impermanent? Yes, they are. They're that impermanent. Yeah. So, spiritual pleasant feeling lasts a long time. You can sit there and have that sense of bliss for hours on end, literally. just sitting there blissing out with a serene, beautiful happiness for 1, 2, 3 hours or more. No problems. It's not that difficult to do. So it lasts a long time. The second characteristic it has is that it's pervasive. It fills your whole body. Whereas ordinary pleasant feelings, you're only feeling a part of your body. Yeah? If you're feeling of taste, you only feel it in your tongue. If you have beautiful music, you only hear it with your ears. Beautiful sight, you only see it with your eyes. Something is beautiful to touch, you only feel it with your skin. Only part of your body experiences that. Whereas in the pleasant feeling in meditation is your whole being is immersed in that. And this is one of the kinds of similes that the Buddha used again and again and again to describe these feelings, like immersing your body, like he used a simile like the pot of oil, like a pot which is filled to the brim with oil, so that if you moved in a little bit, it would drip over the side. Or the simile of the lotus, which is sunk into the water, it's growing in the water, so that it's filled and soaked through with water the whole way through. Always these similes, these images of pervasion, your whole being, your whole field, your whole body of experience is immersed in this bliss. So this is the second feeling of this bliss. It lasts a long time and it's pervasive. And the third one is that it's very subtle. Sukhana, sukha. Subtle happiness. It's not strong. It's not like an overt, powerful feeling. It's very subtle. Very, very subtle. So subtle that when it becomes very strong and very subtle like that, you can hardly even see it. You hardly even know it's there. You could almost suspect that it's not there anymore. You can almost feel, oh, I'm not feeling anything anymore. If you lose your mindfulness a bit, actually, there's a very deep, pervasive sense of bliss. So these are the three essential characteristics of this kind of spiritual bliss, which you should all of you be looking for in your meditation and developing. It lasts a long time. It's pervasive through your whole field, your whole body, your whole field of experience, and it's very subtle. When you get that kind of bliss, that kind of rapture, then that will lead your mind into concentration. So when the Buddha talked about these, he talked about these two aspects, Bhiti and Sukha. Bhiti is the sense of uplift, rapture. Sukha is the sense of pleasure, almost the kind of weighty sense of bliss. Sukha, uplifting. Sorry, Bhiti, rapture, uplifting. And the Sukha, being settling. And when these things are like in balance, and all the other mental factors of the mind are in balance, and this leads to samadhi, leads to concentration of mind. And so through this development of feelings, in a very subtle way, that we learn to abandon the hindrances, that we learn to make the mind still and peaceful, and that we learn to let go of that kind of need, that craving for stimulus. And that very subtle, pleasant feeling from meditation, that will ripen into an even more subtle, neutral feeling. So this neutral feeling, or equanimity in Buddhism, always, if it's developed properly, emerges at the end. So in every kind of list of dhammas where we mention equanimity and neutral feeling, it always comes at the end, after these other things. If you try to do it at the beginning, it's not going to work. You can do it a bit, but don't do it too much. You need that pleasant feeling, and when that pleasant feeling is fully matured, then it will ripen in that equanimity. Okay? So when that fully matured pleasure has ripened in equanimity, that's when that neutral feeling will flip over. That's when it's not no longer the counterpart of ignorance. That's when it becomes the counterpart of true knowledge. of realization. That kind of neutral feeling, that neutral feeling which comes from the total maturity and transcendence of pleasant feeling. And when you can experience that, then knowledge arises. So the Buddha said, Samadhi Upanishad, Yatha Bhuta Jnanavasana. That samadhi is the vital condition for knowing and seeing things as they really are. So this comes out of, emerges out of this progressive development and refinement of feeling. And of course this neutral feeling is on the basis of true knowledge, because when you have that neutral feeling, your mind isn't being distorted anymore. In pleasant feeling, even in the most subtle pleasant feelings, in samadhi or jhana or whatever it is, there's this kind of a subtle pull of the mind. It's a kind of a subtle distortion of it, almost like a field of gravity, which is just kind of subtly pulling something out. And so that's necessary to stick your mind to this meditation object, to hold it still, so it's like kind of sucking it in there and holding it still. But when that's complete and the mind's completely rested, then there's just a feeling of there's no need to have that. And so the mind becomes this like the purity. The Buddha said the purity of mindfulness and equanimity. And that's like perfectly round and still and bright. And so this is the mind which is ideal for seeing the truth, because it's not being even sucked around by this very, even the most subtle or refined kind of pleasant feeling. It has that neutral feeling. But even that neutral feeling is still a feeling. It's still a sankhara. It's still conditioned. And that goes too. And so in Nibbana, the Buddha said, Nibbana and Paramang Sukham. Nibbana is the highest bliss, ultimate bliss. And one time somebody came and asked Venerable Sariputta, he said, Sariputta, how can Nibbana be the highest bliss if there's nothing felt there? Seems like a sensible enough question. But people worry about it, don't they? Why should I bother trying to realize Nibbana when I'm not going to feel anything there? It's kind of dead. Living in Nibbana is just this kind of emotional desert. My little distracts from Mogadon or something, I don't know. I don't feel anything to be like Nibbana here and now. Living in this kind of emotional vacuum. So Nibbana said, Sariputta said, that's why it's ultimate bliss, because there's nothing found there. And then he meant to explain that. He didn't explain it by teaching the philosophy of feelings. He didn't explain that by rationally showing how that can be the case. He explained that by talking about this development of feelings that I've been talking about in the meditation. Abandoning worldly feelings, developing spiritual feelings, refining those spiritual feelings, rapture, the bliss, the equanimity, transcending all of those feelings. And at each time, what you realize is letting go of all of those feelings is just so blissful. Letting go of all that stuff in the world is so blissful. I felt so happy about it. But then even letting go of that happiness is even more blissful. I feel this kind of sense of total social pleasure. But letting go of that sense of pleasure is even more blissful. Feeling equanimity, that's even more blissful. Total neutral and equanimous. That's even more blissful than feeling pleasant feeling. And what would be happen? What would it be like to go even beyond that? If letting go of all those other feelings gave us such a more profound sense of bliss, incomparably more profound sense of bliss and happiness, what is it going to be like to let go of this one? This feeling that's so subtle that it's hardly a feeling at all. What is it going to be like even to let go of that? What kind of bliss would that be? The experience with my talk here this evening on feelings, contemplation of feelings. And I hope that's been of some benefit for you all. So does anybody have any comments or questions? To always just try to focus on the positive as much as you can, and that's always the best thing. And just don't be silly. It's very helpful. Yeah. But often we take ourselves too seriously, and that's why we get depressed and stuff. So just about really care about silly things, like if you kind of throw away the rice grains, say, "Oh, Sandra, it's one of those wonderful ants get to eat all my little rice grains." And these kinds of things. And if so somebody walks into the door, you think, "Oh, it's amazing, they're still alive today. Isn't that wonderful?" People who think like that, and they're very happy people. People who are always critical about things aren't happy. So it's all right to be critical, but only a certain amount of you. Any certain amount. You need to have a strong basis of happiness, otherwise your vehicle mind just becomes neurotic. Catching child could be incredibly silly, yeah. Used to crack very close jokes and really make fun of people. Over time when the monk came and he ordained as a monk in India under the Bodhi tree. And Ajahn Chah said, "Oh, where did you ordain as a monk?" He said, he just arrived in Thailand and his Thai was very bad. So he tried to say under the Bodhi tree in Thai, but actually what he said was underneath a flat. Delusion mechanism. Yeah? The delusion with that is what makes you not be aware of it. Because if you were aware of it, you realize that actually it's not that good. Yeah? So this is like the trick. And that's what we do in our minds. It's exactly the same as like advertising and so on. They just present to you everything that's good about something. So it presents this face, and actually it's not that great. Yeah? It's just another gadget or just another product or whatever. It's the same when you take the mouth of the fruit. There's this kind of expectation in your mind and that's kind of unexamined. And when you taste it, it's just another taste and it's all right. But the mind will deliberately distract itself in order to kind of convince itself that it's really present. As I was saying before, you sit at dinner table and you've got to eat the food and chat and drink the wine and it's kind of, and all of those things are kind of like a constant. Shifting away from actually what's there, what's pleasant, so to convince yourself that it's pleasant. Yeah? And so there's that requires that constant shifting away. If you just sit there in a plain, ordinary, dull room with nothing there and you eat the food, you realize actually it's just kind of food. Your taste is just there all the time. And so you just need to try to bring your feeling back to just taste it as much as you can. because everything is, because we like to taste it when we first eat it, but then after you've chewed it a few times, it doesn't taste so good anymore. And then that's what we know about. I was ill. What happened? Oh, I think I'd just come out of the hospital for an operation on my knee or something like that, and I was getting picked up and taken back to the monastery. And I ran over the local supporters who lived nearby, and he was going down to offer Dharma, and he said, oh, yeah, okay, I've got to pick up, but before we go to the monastery, I've got to drop back my house and pick up the pizzas, okay? They're in the oven. And they were warming up the pizzas, so I thought, okay, I didn't think twice about it, and I just came up and picked me up, and we went back to his house, got the pizzas. Going back to it, driving down to the highway, you can just kind of smell the pizza in the car. And I didn't think about it, as I get there, and he's like, oh yeah, when I get there, I have to make sure I ring them up beforehand, make sure the oven's preheated, so that I can put the pizza back in the oven for another 10 minutes to reheat them. And I'm like, well, yeah, okay, whatever you want to do with food, that's fine with me. And I'm trying to get there, and because I could, my leg was better, because I couldn't eat in the main cell, so I could just put some food in my bowl and took out to me right there. I was in the Sipsipmunk's room. And I sort of went up there and then someone made the food, brought it up to me, and I sort of opened my bowl and looked at him and was like, there's no pizza. Your attachment. Yeah? It was because I didn't get it. So I should have said thank you very much that night. I probably didn't, but I should have. Mature and deepen. So you have to make sure you keep your basis on the physicality of your meditation. If it's breath meditation, that's also a way of emphasizing metta. You keep your feeling in your body, so you get the groundedness. Yeah? And don't let yourself get swept away.
Always.
Always, yeah, always. You really, eventually you leave your body behind, but you leave your body behind not by floating up and getting swept away by it. You leave your body behind by going into it and through it. Yeah? So that you like go through the other side of it. It's not because you're ignoring your body, but because you're so totally aware of it that you go through it to the other side. Again, that's not a rational explanation, that's just how it feels like. So that's why you need that pleasant feeling. Pleasant feeling is only one of the factors in concentration. Yeah, there's all the other factors as well. And you need that constant reminder of that centeredness, that groundedness. It's very, very important. situation. You know, you'd think that, you know, if something's painful, therefore the mind would have turned away from it and shut it out. And it does to some degree, but it also tends to obsess about it. Because it's like an attachment, as a worry, you've got some sickness in your body and that kind of thing. You know, people who have quadriplegics and things like that, they usually have very intense pain from their body, parts of the body that they can't use, and then after a number of years, then that will fade away and disappear. It takes a long time for them to train to not do that. I was told about this by a friend who was a quadriplegic, a meditator, and he said he was the only quadriplegic he knew of that hadn't happened to, because he was a meditator and he just trained himself to just look at the feelings as they were, and so they hadn't kind of disappeared like that. They didn't go away. Mixed blessing. Said more than enough already. Why the normal kind of field of experience is complex, because there's this kind of intermingling of present and sorry, bodily and mental feelings, which we don't normally distinguish that clearly. And as long as you've got bodily feelings, you have to have mental feelings as well, because the mind is always there. But the other doesn't always apply. You can't have mental feelings without having any body there. That's one of the reasons why, you know, ultimately in meditation you just absorb into those present mental feelings, because it's simpler.